Accession number 3998, reel 2.
Major Hassock, tape number 2. You were telling me about your domestic arrangements at Al Abbey.
Oh, yes.
What sort of food did your cook?
We used to have English-type food in the main. They used to, you know, the usual meat. Used to have beef and various meats. We didn't have to resort to anything unusual in the way of food. Well, not whilst we were in what we used to call our peace station. Our peace station was, of course, the actual station where we were based, where our home was, in other words. And my peace station, of course, in the Camel Corps with number 2 Company was in El Obeid.
What was the setup at El Obeid?
Well, there was the native town, and then the British community lived in what was an enclave. And inside a fence, in other words. And the whole British community was in this enclave, both civilian administrative staff and the Sudan Defence Force personnel. And with it being the headquarters of the Camel Corps, of course, you had the senior Camel Corps officers there, had the head of the Camel Corps, the commanding officer, was Mirulai, and the second in command was Kai Makam. And at the time I joined the Camel Corps, it was the Mirulai. Baird, Mirulai Baird, who was acknowledged to be one of the most fluent Arabic speakers of the British officials in Sudan at that time. And the Kai Makam was named Keys, Kai Makam Keys, Bay, he always had Bay after the name. And then there was a senior native officer of the Camel Corps, it was a Kai Makam. I think he was a Kai Makam, if I recall. Yes, he was Kai Makam, and his name was Abdullah Khalil, who became the first Prime Minister of the Sudan on its independence. He retired from the Sudan Defence Force and became the first, or at least I knew somebody who was a big cheese in the independent setup in 54 when they got independence. But he was an extremely nice man, and then they had the Motor Machine Gun Company. Was the only company in El Obeid. It had, of course, been a camel company prior to my going there. And there was a camel company out at a place called Bara, which was due to be mechanized, and which I was later to become the first initiating BNCO and instructor with this new company, training them from camel drivers to become drivers. And and mechanise the unit. And our position as BNCOs and technical people out in the Sudan was to help in the mechanisation of various corps, both the Western and Eastern Arab Corps and the Camel Corps. And I won one BNCO to do this, incidentally. And anyway, I was going back, I'll go back, keep on the domestic life for a while. Now, it was an extremely lonely life for one British NCO. Now, in El Obeid, there was a mechanical transport workshops, which Ella Baird in those days, being the railhead, was the main workshops of the Sudan Defence Force outside of Khartoum, and its prime function was to maintain a convoy of vehicles that was going between the only means of communication, really, between El Obeid and El Fasher in Darfur province, some, I think, about 300 miles away. And this convoy of vehicles used to take supplies and so forth between the from the railhead, El Obeid, to El Fasher once a week. And the checkout used to take about 3 days of the day's rest and 3 days back. And this road, of course, right through the desert, was in the Sudan, was known as the worst road in the world. And it was anything to... I did it once with the convoy, and it was anything from 300 or 400 yards to 3 miles wide, according to how you managed to get through the sand. The vehicles were heavy old Thornycroft lorries with very hard tires, not the later pneumatic sand tires. These were pneumatic tires, but they were quite narrow tires. And it used to be quite a feat getting these Thornycroft lorries from El Obeid to Fasher and back. And regularly. And that was the principal object of this large workshops. And of course, they also maintained any heavy repairs of the machine gun company. And the company was commanded by, the workshops rather, was commanded by a British officer. And supervised, the workshops were supervised by a British NCO who later, while I was there, became a warrant officer, because the workshops expanded with the formation of another machine gun company, putting more onus onto the base workshops there, and so they promoted the VNCO to a warrant officer grade, which meant more money. You had when you went to the Sudan Defence Force, you were seconded, you were classed as a Sudan government official and given a grade. Well, grade 5 was the lowest grade of the white officials, and all new NCOs going in, being seconded, were grade 5 officials, and you had your passport stamped, endorsed, with this by the Sudan government headquarters in Khartoum. It was embossed that you were Sudan government official for the purpose of getting, of course, in and out of Egypt and the Sudan. And you were grade 5. And you stayed grade 5 until you became a warrant officer class 1. But when you were promoted to warrant officer class 1, you became grade 4, which was the senior grade of the, what you might call, the non-officer grades. And these grades were also parallel to the grades of the civilian officials. For instance, you'd get the lowest grade civilian official would be a British official, I'm talking about, of course. The lowest grade British official would be a grade 5, and then the senior non-executive type grade as a British official was grade 4, and these grade 4 types were in offices such as the chief clerks in the various Board of Trade or the Civil Secretary's office and all that sort of thing. They were grade 4, so to be a grade 4, non-officer types, was a pretty high grading. And, of course, your salary went according to your grade. You had an increase every year of £36, which doesn't seem very much, but in those days it was quite something. The starting rate for a technical NCO was £324 a year. And we used to get an allowance of £2 a month servant allowance, which went, because that was what you paid your servant. Actually, you paid more because you had to have two servants, and you'd pay £2 to your suffragette or cook, and then probably £2 to your other boy as well. But you'd get the £2 servant allowance, and every year you had this £36 rise. Well, if you, as I was, I later became grade four, but this is out of the time of this talk, and then your increment each year was £48, and your basic pay as a grade four official was £432 salary. That's a year, of course, the annual salary. So that you started on 324, which was around about £27 a month, and you had £2 servant allowance, and this was paid into your bank in Cartoon by the Sudan Defence Force Records, Pay and Records Office, and whilst you lived by cheque, you didn't used to carry very much currency with you, and you lived with bills, you know, everything was done by a weekly order from the local Greek merchant as far as fooding and household utensils and necessities were concerned, and then you had a small amount of currency which you gave usually 10 piastres a day for your own food, which you gave to your cook every night. 10 piastres being the equivalent of 2 bob. So he would buy your meat and fresh fruits and vegetables for that 10p for the day. And, of course, your dried stuff, such as your tea and bread, the 10p would cover the bread, the cook would buy the bread, but the dried foods you would get from the Greek merchant and pay monthly by bill and by on account. Now the social life, was very difficult for a British NCO. He was extremely alone. If he was, he'd be with a machine gun company, the only one of three white officials. The other two were officers, and of course, being officers, they were more friendly to each other. I mean, myself, I was always addressed by my surname. If I was referred to, it was Mr. Hassock, but when I was spoken to in the course of conversation, I was addressed as Hassock from surname. And you got used to this. I never addressed you, as I said, by your rank, because this wasn't done. You were always Mr. If you were referring to another British NCO or warrant officer, it was always Mr. If you were referring to an officer, it was always his rank, Bimbashi. Bimbashi was the lowest British officer rank. And the type of British officers that I came across were in the main extremely nice, understanding and friendly. You did sometimes come across what I referred to as a snobbish type of officer. And usually, this type of officer was soon advised how to behave to a British NCO, presumably by the other officers. But one's life as an NCO was extremely different, because you immediately became to live the life of an officer. You had the same staff that they had. You had a house similar to theirs. Theirs was usually a little bit better, perhaps an extra room or an extra little bit of mosquito proofing on a window or veranda. The setup was not very different from the officers and the British NCOs. They didn't make, for instance, special houses for British NCOs. I mean, the house that a British NCO had would perhaps have been occupied by Bimbashi at some other period, and vice versa. And the social side of life was work started about six. And I beg your pardon, the life itself, work, you started life about six in the morning, and you went and did 2 hours on the job, whatever you were doing, and then breakfast 8 to 9, then back till about 1 o'clock, and that was the day. And then, after, as I say, we finished, usually finished about 1 o'clock, and this was in our pre-station I'm talking about now, not when we're on track, in your station, home station, and then you'd usually go away for lunch, and you didn't, with the setup, the offices were away from the garage area where the vehicles were. A machine gun company had its own independent setup with its own garages and its own workshop. And that is where the British NCO spent all of his on-duty time. The British officers, the administrative officers, were usually away from the garage area. Consequently, you didn't often see the British officers during working hours. Sometimes they'd come up and have a look at the vehicles, inspection and all that sort of thing, but during the day one was on one's own with the with your own Arab native staff. And then after 1 o'clock you'd go back to your house for lunch, and then it usually rest till about 4 o'clock, and then it was always you get into a sort of routine. You meet up with the Bimbashir for company, and sometimes you go out and knock a golf ball about together, sometimes you play tennis together, or sometimes you, if you're in a station where there's a squash court, you play squash. And consequently, the life of a BNCO socially in that respect was entirely different from the life of, he was leading before he came into the before he left the British Army. And then in the evening, then that usually lasted an hour to an hour and a half, from about 4 till about 5:30, and then it was getting dusk and you'd break off, and sometimes you'd go in turn to tea. Sometimes there were three of you, two British officers and BNCO, or sometimes there were just two, because more often than not, in the time I was out with the Camel Corps, one of the officers was always either under establishment, or off sick, or on leave. So more often than not, there were just the two of you. And you would then go to each other's bungalow for tea, in turn. And perhaps two or three times a week you'd meet for a drink. After tea you'd go and have your baths, and then you'd meet for drinks. Here again, the life again for a British NCO was entirely different. You always dressed for dinner, the old Pukka Saab business. And dressing for dinner was civilian. You lived a life of a civilian in whites with black cummerbund, the black cummerbund and tie, if there was more than two of you, as I recall. I can't remember if when there was only two of us together we wore a bow tie. I can't remember that. We may have done, I can't recall. But we all certainly always dressed. And there would be just the two of us, miles from anywhere, and go and have drinks, and then perhaps he'd have drinks with me in my bungalow, or we'd go across to his bungalow for drinks and he would come over to me and have dinner, or vice versa. In El Obeid, the social life was a little bit higher. There was an El Obeid club, there was a club there, and with more British civilian officials. And you could go to the club. There was more variety of company and companionship there, which made it a little bit more of a variety. And also, you could get away with when, as I was telling you about the addressing of a BNCO by the officers. The officers, of course, always expected to be called sir. So you were always calling somebody sir. But nobody was ever calling you other than your surname, you see, which you got used to. But you never got officers call themselves by each other by the Christian names, as did all the senior officials. But unless you were with junior officials or your own brother British NCOs, you rarely got called by your own Christian name. But in El Obeid, and again, of course, we're in the towns where there were a bigger white community, then that official breakdown did come about, and the friendliness was a little bit more pronounced than it was when you were living out on your own. But by and large, I always got on very well with my British officers in the Camel Corps, and you had to. You really had to, as they had to, because they were dependent on you, and as you were on them. And when you were alone, certainly when you were on trek, if one of you became ill, then the other depended on you to help look after him, because you had no medical attention or assistance anywhere near. And after I had been in with number two company for I think it was about 18 months or so, at this time I was also going to go, knew I was going to be posted to a new Camel Corps company in an outpost 40 miles away, which was a day's trek by camel, or about 4 hours by vehicle from El Obeid, because of the terrain, very desert terrain, scrub country. I used to go out to Barra. The name of the station was Barra, and see how the new garages were being built, and sometimes go up to Khartoum to see how the Camel Corps driver, the Camel Corps troops were being trained to become drivers and technicians. As I said, I was already helping them when I was first in the mechanical transport workshops, and also in El Obeid, I had some of the number four company from Barra. Was a new company that was going to be formed. I had some of their native troops with me in El Obeid, also training under me, both in as drivers and technicians. And after I think it was about 2 years, 18 months, 2 years in El Obeid, I was posted to number four company at Barra, which was this brand new company. I had to go up to Khartoum and collect the new vehicles, and the transfer vehicles with the machine gun companies were all Fords, with number two company being an older company, we had the older type Fords, which were four-cylinder Fords, known as B models, and or the B series, and my new company, which was formed in 1936, was model 67 series, which were V8 engine, very hot rod Fords, very good, very fast. But and they had sand tyres. Sand tyres being a broader treaded tyre, wider wheels. And as a matter of fact, I think there was something in the region of on the vans which the officers had, and the machine gun vans, I think there was something in the region of about 8.25 in cross section width. And the truck tyres, they were 30 hundredweight type trucks for the troops, personnel carriers, they were 10.50 by 16 tyres. I think the van tyres were 8.25 by 13, but they were very good sand tyres. But in those days, transport in the desert was in its infancy. We didn't have such things as we came later on when the war we again experienced in the desert. We didn't have sand channels, which became into use in the early war years on the Western Desert. But we did eventually devise sand mats, which were fabric mats with strips of cane in them. And these rolled up, and you'd carry them on each vehicle too, which you'd put under the wheels if you got bogged down in sand. You also had each vehicle had its own spade to help digging out of sand, and this was quite a problem. And especially the terrain round where I was in my new station in Barra with the new company, it was very heavy sand and very little rain. Consequently, there was no respite from this very loose, soft sand. It wasn't hard sand as you got on some parts of the Western Desert, but it was all very soft, loose sand and undulating, very high sand dunes. And the area around Barra was known as the Heran, which means is the plural of Khor, K-H-O-R, being